Greetings, dear listeners. Welcome back to the podcast hosted by the Católica Lisbon Economics Club. As you may have noticed, today we shift our attention from our typical Portuguese episodes to English and return to the discussion of pressing current events. As always, my name is Francisco Sanch. For those new English-speaking listeners, I'm a student at Católica Lisbon. I'm taking a master's in economics and I'm Portuguese. I'm joined today by Eva Trinian. Welcome to the podcast, Eva. Can you let us know a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm also studying my master's in economics. I previously did my undergrad in the Netherlands. I studied philosophy, politics, and economics. And in general, my interests are they range from economic development to international justice. I'd say I'm very up for any interdisciplinary discussions surrounding economics. And yeah, I'm excited about today's episode.
Perfect. Yeah, I think you'll be a fantastic fit for today's episode, given the topics we'll be discussing. Thank you for introducing yourself. I'll take this opportunity to give the listeners an overview of today's topics. And of course, we'll be starting with the resignation of António Costa, the Prime Minister of Portugal, which is effectively breaking news as of 4 or 5 hours ago. Then we'll move on to the rising drug of Ozempic that is actually called semaglutide. And we'll finalize this podcast with a discussion on the European energy crisis. So moving straight on to the first topic, which is the resignation of the Prime Minister of Portugal. Effectively, what happened is that António Costa is facing a corruption charge with regards to business related to lithium and hydrogen projects. And due to the nature of Portugal's semi-presidential system, the President of the Republic has, although he has no directive executive power, he does have moderator power. So he received António Costa's resignation. And he accepted it. We were scheduled for a government budget approval on the 29th of November. The government budget for Portugal was unveiled on October, just the last few weeks of October, for the year 2024. And given that the Prime Minister of Portugal has resigned, we are unsure of what's going to happen to the voting for the 29th of November.
So considering this important decision around the government budget, as you mentioned, what can we expect to happen now?
Yeah, that's a fair question. It really depends on, I think, individuals' expectations. But the truth is that given the President of Portugal, he's the President of the Assembly of the Republic of Portugal, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa. Sorry, I don't think I had mentioned his name before. But the likelihood is he has, and because of his power as a moderator, he has the power, the rights to dissolve parliament. And here's where it really depends on individuals' expectations. I think most people will wager in favor of Marcelo dissolving the parliament, and therefore we'll have to have elections. Given we'll have elections, there's absolutely no chance that there's going to be a vote for the government budget on the 29th. In fact, if the parliament is dissolved, the likelihood is a new parliament will be instituted, which will have different priorities in regards to their government budget. In any case, for the year 2024, what will happen is the current budget will be split into 12 pieces, and for each month, 1/12 is assigned. Such that government can maintain its functions throughout 2024 as elections occur and the new government budget is drawn up.
I see. As a foreigner to Portuguese politics, it's a bit difficult to piece everything together. So could you maybe elaborate on what was the political inclination of the current party in power? And what do you think will be the backlash of this political outcome?
Right. I mean, the current party in power, as you said quite well, is Partido Socialista, which is a socialist party. I think most people will identify socialist parties as left-leaning parties, and Partido Socialista represents itself as a center-left party, although I would argue that it's perhaps more left than center-left, but that's up to debate. I think that due to general discontentment around the Portuguese population and the corruption charges that António Costa is facing, given, I mean, assuming that we head towards elections, which is a very high likelihood of happening, I would wager on a shift towards more right-leaning parties, which I think is a relatively natural assumption.
I see. And do you feel like these news could have been expected, considering the political landscape?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, as any Portuguese person will know, there is historical precedent around the Socialist Party and, let's say, infamous corruption charges. José Sócrates, which was also a previous Prime Minister of Portugal, still faces very serious corruption charges, although he has found ways to evade justice so far. The truth is, no one really ever expects the highest order minister to be implicated in these kinds of events. And because I think people, although we tend to joke on a very negative outlook, we always try to believe on the best outcome possible. So no one really ever expects a prime minister to be implicated in such serious charges. Having said that, in May of 2023, João Galamba was involved in this precise corruption charge. And João Galamba is the current Minister of Infrastructure. Given these charges he faced, he presented his resignation to António Costa in May, but António Costa felt that the right information wasn't there for him to be charged, and therefore he didn't accept his resignation, and João Galamba still serves as minister to this day. So, I mean, you could perhaps see that there is a precedent within António Costa in this most recent government, excluding all other previous historical events. In any case, I think, so in our previous podcast, we interviewed Luís Marques Mendes, who used to be a minister himself in the Portuguese parliament. And he stated something quite interesting, and bear in mind I'm paraphrasing and also translating from Portuguese to English. And effectively he said that long stints in government positions tend to result in people being disconnected from reality and also just the general population. And I think perhaps there is a future discussion to be had on the persistence of political roles without intervals. And Luís Marques Mendes has actually, he himself had political roles for a very long time, but he's since taken a break and returned back into more of, let's say, a normal outside of politics role, because he feels there is this necessity to ingratiate yourself within a society outside of government. In any case, I think it's a good opportunity to move on to the second topic for the day, which is, you know, the rising sensation in the medical drug world, and that is semaglutide. More specifically, I think people know it as Ozempic and Wegovy. That's the type of brand names it's sold under. In the same way that ibuprofen is sold under Brufen, semaglutide is sold under Ozempic and Wegovy. It's manufactured by Novo Nordisk, which is a pharmaceutical company. And its original intention was for the treatment of diabetes, in particular type 2 diabetes. For those that don't know, the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes is that type 2 diabetes is also considered adult onset diabetes. So it typically arises from it arises in adulthood or, well, later childhood, and it typically comes as a result of poor dietary and exercise habits. Of course, not only these cases, but in general. And as a treatment of diabetes, it was first approved in the United States in 2017 by the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, and it was sold under the brand name of Ozempic. Then, of course, these, let's say, further effects were found where it resulted as an appetite suppressant. And because of these effects, medical trials in 2021 discovered that higher dose formulations were very effective as a weight management drug. And then, of course, given these trials, the FDA approved it as a weight loss drug, so beyond its initial goal of being a diabetes treating drug. in 2021, and then it was approved in 2022 within the European Union.
Okay, so with all of that in mind, I can tell that these are quite recent developments in the field of medical science. Personally, I was made aware that Ozempic is making waves through celebrities and social media in particular. So my question is, what has been the result of this publicity and interest in Ozempic?
Right. It's a valid question. Obviously, the trend, especially with social media nowadays, due to its exposure, is that things are perhaps misunderstood, and people tend to, I think people tend to absorb these kind of issues faster. So perhaps the right information isn't being translated in the correct ways. But in any case, there has been extremely increased global interest. In fact, public figures such as Elon Musk will publicly state on Twitter that they are using WeGovi, which is the weight management version, well, higher formulation of semaglutide or Ozempic. And I think it has translated into, as I have said previously, increased global interest due to its relative ease of use compared to like traditional methods of weight management and diabetes management, which is exercise and dieting. And it's translated in shortages. Especially this year, we've had the UK Department of Health entirely banned the sales of semaglutide products for weight management. So they've only allowed, from July onwards, they only allowed sales of semaglutide products for diabetic patients. And now in October, they also banned new prescriptions because they've had such large shortages, they can't even fulfill the requirements for diabetic patients. And it's already also being explored by the Belgian government, and the Belgian health minister has announced that there is likely going to be a temporary ban on upcoming sales of semaglutide products for weight management, so therefore only maintaining its goal for diabetic treatment. Of course, this has all resulted in Novo Nordisk being an extremely well-valued company. Its stock price has increased over 60% in the last year. In fact, in the last 5 days, it's increased almost 5%, so basically a percent a day. And its current stock price is around 700 Danish krones, which also translates to approximately 90 euros, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Now, when we consider these new medical trends, I think people tend to gravitate towards the medical and ethical considerations. However, considering the nature of this podcast, do you think you could share a perspective from an economist's point of view?
Yeah, I think I can try. If I can even call myself an economist, I'd like to think so. But starting from the beginning, when we're looking at the results of any medicinal treatment, we want to think about a causal relationship, because we want to isolate the things that make that drug work such that it presents the results we want. The issue that we face here is that diabetes, or specifically type 2 diabetes, and weight, in particular obesity, are heavily related. In fact, I mean, type 2 diabetes tends to arise as a symptom of obesity, right? So the first thing we would have to do is we'd have to separate these two effects. Another important challenge is the socioeconomic one, and in the sense that obesity and diabetes, by nature, are related to differences in socioeconomic backgrounds, because people with lower socioeconomic backgrounds tend to have, let's say, less healthy lifestyles. In the sense, it can be in the sense that they're not aware of the benefits of proper dieting and exercise, and it can also be in the sense that they have to purchase cheaper or less lower quality food items because they don't have as much money. And so we face these two significant challenges when we're looking at the overall effect of semaglutide on diabetes treatment and obesity, because we have to isolate these effects before we can find the true result of drugs such as semaglutide on weight loss. And then I'd also like to give something that economists typically like to do when we're looking at these kind of situations, which is conduct a brief cost and benefit analysis. And obviously we have a clear immediate benefit in the sense that, these semaglutide injections are weekly injections, right? You inject yourself once in the leg, the arm, whatever, and it's only once a week, and it's relatively low risk. Compared to what? Compared to traditional surgeries such as traditional weight loss surgeries such as gastric bypass. And these are very invasive surgeries because they involve tightening your stomach with a band such that it results in the same kind of appetite suppressant effect that semaglutide injections do. So there's that clear immediate effect in terms of a psychological benefit that patients receive from the differences between semaglutide and typical weight loss management surgeries. Then, of course, there are very clear benefits in terms of the costs being saved. Weight loss surgery is extremely expensive, and these costs are typically in the tens of thousands, especially in the United States. So in the future, as more competition arises, hopefully there will be more products that are similar to or even replace Novo Nordisk's drugs so that the price will keep going down over time. Whereas with surgery, there isn't really anything you can do to decrease the cost because it's a service. And with services, it's always harder to change prices because they're tied to wages. Whereas with products, it's easier as long as there's more competition. And so that's a very clear benefit in terms of the reduction of costs for the individual. And then the final benefit I would say is that in particular, the US is extremely burdened by the medical costs related to obesity. So to give some context, in 2019, the estimated annual medical costs for just related to obesity were $173 billion. For perspective, this is almost as much as the entire GDP of a country like Portugal and Greece. So these are non-negligible costs. And obviously, if there's a new effective way to reduce weight-related diseases, this could be a very big release on the burden of the American healthcare system, especially because obesity continues to trend upwards in the United States. And then naturally, there are also costs, right? Because with every benefit, there is also a cost. And in particular, with medication specifically, whenever there's a positive effect to a medication, there are also unwanted side effects. In fact, the side effects to semaglutide injections are things such as nausea, vomiting, etc., things that are actually quite significant. And the prolonged use of these drugs could result in very serious consequences. And then this leads quite well into the next issue, which is this over-reliance on the lack of appetite that semaglutide injections give does not really treat the cause. It only treats the symptoms. So I think there needs to be a better cultural approach to dieting and exercise in the United States to really tackle the rising obesity rates in the United States. Because otherwise, if people become too reliant on these drugs, then as soon as they're off their drugs, the likelihood is they're going to gain back all the weight. And that's what seems to be the empirical evidence. So one could imagine that in the long run, these will be very significant costs in the form of relapses, in the sense that people, as soon as they come off the drug, they end up putting the weight back on, and addiction, because they want to keep the weight off, so they keep consuming the drugs. And then I think that summarizes, summarizes quite well these immediate costs and benefits for the semaglutide injections. And I think in the short term, I would argue at least that semaglutide definitely seems to have overwhelming positive effects. But in the long run, especially because this is such a new drug, the costs could very easily overcome the positive benefits.
I see. Yeah, I think it's important that you mentioned the long run costs with these types of medicines, like you did in the cost benefit analysis. Personally, it reminds me of a similar drug called Mediator, which had originally been developed by a French company to help people with cases of overweight diabetes. So this is also very similar to what Ozempic is originally being used and was designed for. And I remember that once the appetite suppressant properties and the weight loss properties of Mediator were discovered, this became propagated across the country, and there were cases of severe misuse and abuse of the medication. Nowadays, it's allegedly considered to have caused the deaths of thousands of people in France. Between 500 and 2,000 people is estimated. And in the end, this French company, which made Mediator available for nearly 50 years, is now facing enormous lawsuits over charges of fraud and manslaughter. And they're also offering a compensation to Mediator victims upwards of 200 million euros.
Right. I think that could definitely be a kind of future outlook on Ozempic's future, because it's important to realize that these are very recent medical studies and results. And obviously the FDA and the EU have just approved it very recently. 1-2 years is not enough to conclude anything on the kind of long-run effects for this kind of drug. And I think Mediator could definitely be a representation of Ozempic's future, of course. It goes without saying that we do not provide medical advice, so we always advise people to consult their own physicians. But I think it's going to be interesting to follow the long-run dependence and effects of Ozempic and seeing how it matches to Mediator, as you very well mentioned. And now, to conclude today's podcast, let's move on to our third and final topic. And Eva, given your undergraduate education and your expertise, I think you've got a better understanding of the background causes. Could you give us a brief overview of what's going on with the European energy crisis?
Yeah, so as our last topic, we are going to elaborate on the energy crisis that took Europe a wave last year. With the context of the war in Ukraine, of course, I think many of us are familiar that since the escalation of the Russo-Ukrainian conflict in 2022, the war in Ukraine has caused an unprecedented rise of energy prices in Europe. Speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that I noticed my gas and electricity bill increase sometimes twofold or threefold. And I think that was the case for most Europeans. Even though the international conflict has implied repercussions on the entire global market of energy, it's especially the EU that was all the more concerned because of its considerable dependence on Russian energy imports. So just to give you a quick overview of how European production and consumption of energy is mapped out, I wanted to give you a few facts and percentages about energy in Europe. So we know that 68.4% of all EU energy is produced from coal, oil, and natural gas. But EU production is far from sufficient for EU consumption. Its own production is only able to meet 48.5% of the demand in Europe, which is why the EU has long depended on foreign imports to complement their needs of energy consumption, which is why prior to the invasion of Russia, the EU was importing 83% of its natural gas, of which 50% is of Russian origin. And I think that's worth to mention in the current discussion with the war in Ukraine.
Right. So large dependence on Russian energy, and then with the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, there's been a clear negative impact for the European economy as a whole, it would seem. Would you agree?
Yeah, for sure. Negative impact is one way to put it. Well, there's no overall conclusion of how bad the energy crisis has affected European economy. It's already clear that the conflict has had serious implications for some European countries. For example, it's worsened the comparative disadvantages of European countries, and especially those with natural gas industries. With the heightening of tensions, the invasion has also prompted the Russians to use their resources of natural gas as a weapon and to retaliate against the sanctions imposed by the West. So these, let's say, these political warfares and sanctioning measures have drastic implications on national economies. A study by Feriani and Ghazani also demonstrated that there was a negative relationship between European firms and the energy exposure. So more specifically, they found that Europe's equity returns have generally suffered as a result of firms' energy exposure. In statistical terms, they put it as a one standard deviation increase in energy exposure is linked to a 0.9% percentage point decline in European firms' returns. So I'm aware that that's quite loaded language, but in other words, this is already indicating a negative relationship between the returns of European firms and the prices of energy, which adds to the burden that European firms already have when it comes to competing with other continents and other markets. European firms already notably disadvantaged in many industries compared to other countries.
Yeah. I think arguably anyway, the exposure to volatile energy prices having a negative effect on firms' profits isn't really surprising, especially now where the source of so much reliance on Russian energy has closed. But 67% of energy consumption in continental Portugal came from renewable sources in the past year. So I have to wonder what you think, or what are the alternatives for the rest of Europe?
Yeah, that's the right question to ask. And I think the dilemma that a lot of European countries are facing. So in general, individual European countries usually have to choose between essentially two types of energy models. So the recent literature on this explores the different models of energy, which they will refer to as one, a national energy security, and two, the acceleration of energy transition. So it's obviously not black or white, one or two. Many countries will most likely adopt a mixture of both of these models, so that they'll tread the water into a transition for renewable energies while still maintaining their access to more traditional sources such as coal, oil, and fossil fuels. But it is becoming more and more clear that the current climate sets a very difficult precedent for governing powers to shape their new energy models and to set long-term goals in terms of energy transitions. Additionally, the sharp shortage of natural gas supply for the EU is going to require sustainable long-term alternatives to sustain the demand for energy. And on top of that, we are also in a climate change crisis, breaking news. So therefore, the most intuitive response appears to be the acceleration towards renewable energy models, for example, through the implementation of solar and wind power plants. And there is lucidity in this appeal. It is now well known that both of these renewable energies are some of the cheapest and most cost-efficient sources of energy in the world. However, I think that for the sake of this podcast, it's also important to mention that there's always costs when we opt for specific energy models. And in particular, with renewable energies, the initial investment in launching and facilitating the production of wind and solar energy is still very costly, despite the advancement of technology. To be clear, it's not the production of these energies that is the most costly, but it's their initial investment, which makes a huge difference in national economies when launching their short-term solutions. And then we come to the question of what are the other remaining alternatives if it's still so costly to invest in renewable energies. So in developed economies, I think it's worth to mention that nuclear power remains the primary source of low emission electricity and also the second largest source after hydroelectricity, according to the OECD. And in the absence of nuclear power, a study found that between the time frame of 1971 and 2022, there would have been a 20% increase in overall emissions from the production of electricity and a 6% increase in emissions connected to energy. I think those are considerable numbers that cannot be neglected in the consideration of nuclear energy. It's also worth to mention that in contrast to other energy sources, nuclear power can replace fossil fuel plants with it more easeability, I would say, due to the large-scale deployment and reliability of this kind of energy, which is often not the case when we consider renewable energies that require a completely new launch and implementation of specific power plants.
Right. So there are a multitude of choices to be made by all these different European governments. And I mean, this ranges from what I understand for going climate importance, so maintaining fossil fuels, coals, etc., transitioning to renewable, nuclear, or perhaps a mixture of everything. But focusing more on nuclear energy, given this clear source that it can be for this clear primary source that it can be for these countries, I think there are negative connotations surrounding nuclear power due to events that happened in the past. Are there still clear security threats to this source of power nowadays, or do you think it's changed enough?
Yeah, Obviously, this is the most valid question considering nuclear energy. To claim that there are no security threats regarding this type of energy would be very misleading and quite frankly wrong. The historical precedent of nuclear energy is quite tainted by accidents such as Chernobyl and Fukushima that have left quite an important mark on the collective memory of European populations, but also populations globally. I think these accidents linger on the memory of people when they consider the imminent danger of nuclear energy and its potential lifelong devastation that it can cause. That's also why, still within the EU, barely half of the European countries have a positive inclination towards nuclear energy, and I believe only 12 out of 27 countries are willing to host and do host nuclear power plants on their territory. Human error is always a possibility in this type of energy source, which is definitely the most the worrying issue that we're debating here. But then we can also consider the threat of cyber attacks. Nuclear power plants are also considered potential dangers to foreign cyber attacks. Many people ask the question, what if cyber terrorists are able to take over a nuclear power plant and hack into the operation of such a power plant, which would allow for a similar meltdown such as happened in Fukushima. And this is also not an easy worry to answer. Even in nations that have highly developed nuclear power and research programs, the technical ability to handle the cyber threat is incredibly limited in the global, in the entire nuclear sector, frankly. And some states, even those who have developed new nuclear programs, have hardly any safeguards against cyber nuclear threats. So this is still an ongoing issue that states are spending a lot of R&D into to have a viable solution and a safe solution, I would say.
Right. I think perhaps when people hear the cybersecurity context around nuclear power plants, they may think about it in the sense of kind of like the boogeyman. But the truth is, there are significant problems around security, especially when it comes to nuclear power plants. I mean, just now with the Russian and Ukrainian invasion, as the Russians occupy the Ukrainian nuclear power plants, there's always, you know, a kind of population scare of sabotage. And I think, you know, in general with nuclear energy, there are these horrific accidents in the past. There's the cybersecurity as well as, honestly, the physical security context not being particularly favorable in terms of its implementation. So I have to wonder, given all of this, what about the geopolitical context?
Yeah, exactly. I think that leads us to the current geopolitical context, which is right now filled with heightened tensions and threats to national securities. So I believe given this climate, it makes it even more difficult to have a discussion surrounding nuclear energy and to weigh the advantages and disadvantages of such an energy source. I think the reason why is because it makes it harder to consider the viability of this type of energy with all the imminent threats happening in the world, despite the fact that nuclear energy does detain the ability to alleviate the current climate change crisis. I think people right now are a bit too distracted with geopolitical conflicts and war zones that the question of climate change maybe falls to the background. And in the end, a dichotomy persists. So what is the crisis that people consider most pressing? Is it the environmental issue, which begs the question of how nations can accelerate their transition towards renewable energies? Or is it the political warfare that is currently happening and that involves political embargoes, sanctioning, and threats to national economies? Sometimes threats to entire industries, which in turn pose a threat to the livelihood of millions of people.
Right, and I think that's actually quite critical because of how related they are, right? I mean, the climate situation, which is obviously increasingly serious, we can feel it ourselves, better said, and these geopolitical situations. I mean, you've just said it quite well yourself. If we were more reliant on renewable energy and nuclear energy sources within our own countries, I mean, it kind of solves both of these issues, right? It solves both the geopolitical context and its problems, as well as the climate change. So I think you provide quite a good summary on what the European nations are facing and how their governments can tackle energy crisis, and as well as actually something we didn't go into as much, but the climate crisis as well. And having said all that, I think we can both agree that the current situation is certainly complex, whether talking domestic or international events. There is a lot that is currently unraveling that will definitely have a significant impact in the upcoming future, I would say. And I think it's a pretty good place for us to conclude this episode of the Catholic Lisbon podcast. Eva, thank you very much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And I would also recommend our dear listeners to follow our Instagram page at Catholic Lisbon Economics Club. And also, I would recommend our previous interview with Dr. Luis Marc Schminch, if you want some context into what's it like being a politician in Portugal. And I think that's it. Thank you very much. And I wish you the best of continuation to a good week.